Seattle Sports Snapshot. LSU defeated Clemson 42-25 in the college football national championship.
Burrow throws to the end zone, far side, and it is caught by Terrace Marshall. With Darian Kendrick in coverage, it's an LSU touchdown.
MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred announced major sanctions of the Houston Astros' 2017 sign-stealing scandal. Houston GM Jeff Luhnow and manager A.J. Hinch received one-year suspensions from baseball. Astros owner Jim Crane subsequently fired the pair. The Astros also lose first and second round picks in 2020 and 2021 and a $5 million fine.
Cook's got a new coach. According to multiple reports, first from The Athletic, then followed up by ESPN, Nick Rolovich, Hawaii's coach. He won 10 games with the Rainbow Warriors.
Mountain West Coach of the Year.
Runs a similar, not the air raid per se, but something that's very similar.
Snapshot, brought to you by Coors Light, made to chill.
This hour is brought to you by Infinity of Tacoma at 5.
This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Time to put on the show.
Regrets. Pete was asked about his biggest one. The biggest thing he regretted, and his answer yesterday, I think, is one that's shared by most people in Seattle. The biggest regret for this 2019 Seattle Seahawks season was?
Well, we could stay healthy was a big deal. We just couldn't keep our guys. We were going so well late into the year. It was almost game 12 or 13, somewhere in there. We had six guys on the inactives that were healthy, you know, and then all of a sudden it just shifted, and it was just one after another. When the running backs went down, we just took a lot of hits, you know. And
he's right, absolutely, Paul. Injuries certainly sidetracked this season. I think it's a big reason you saw them lose three of their final four regular season games.
Would they have lost three of their final four regular season games with a healthy Chris Carson, with a healthy Rashad Penny, with a healthy Will Disley, with a healthy Justin Britt?
No, I don't think so. I'm not convinced if those guys are healthy, though, that this team is playing for the NFC Championship.
If you base it off of the last, five divisional playoff games where we've seen how poorly they've played in the first half, you would be right, because they would probably be playing from behind.
And that's kind of the question that I have of what does Seattle need to get over this hump? What is Seattle? They've been at about the same spot. Not the exact same spot. There's been fluctuations. But this is five seasons of good enough to get into the playoffs, not good enough to earn a first-round bye, and never good enough to get past the divisional round of the playoffs. They've been to the divisional round three times in the past five seasons. They haven't won at any time. Each of those three games have had pretty much the same storyline. Seattle gets blitzed in the first half, falls way behind, makes an admirable rally, and you come away feeling like, okay, next year they'll be a little bit better, they'll be a little bit improved. They'll get back here. In 2015, it was, hey, there won't be a holdout by Cam Chancellor next season. In 2016, it was, they're gonna make some adjustments, they're gonna bring guys back, they won't have the injuries that they suffered. They haven't gotten past it, and I think it's an important question to answer of why haven't they gotten past it? And I don't think it's strictly injuries. I think injuries is too simple, because if you believe injuries is the primary responsibility, well, just bring everybody back and hope they stay healthy. They don't need to make significant changes this offseason. I think they do need to make some changes.
Are those changes strategy ones, or are those changes we need new talent? We need, as Brock was describing it in the last hour, elite speed with playmaking ability.
You need one or the other. And I don't know. Can you get enough talent to make this defense stand up and hold up its end of the bargain? Not make it as good as it was in 2014, 2013. Can you get enough talent on defense to be able to support the kind of game plan that Pete Carroll wants to play? Because if you can't, you need to change the game plan. If you can't, if this defense is going to be about what it is, and look, their top two draft picks from this previous year's draft, you look at their draft from last year looks pretty good. I think you've seen some pretty good returns on players. At the same time, your top two picks, LJ Collier and Marquise Blair, Well, Collier was a healthy scratch for the final game and was pretty much a non-factor as a rookie. And Marquise Blair, he was hurt. He twisted his ankle last week, but he was not one of the five safeties that you kind of chose to emphasize and start. He never really got run there. In fact, he was displaced by the guy you lucked into in Quandre Diggs. There's no guarantee that another year your defense is going to be... It has to at least be average if you're going to play the way Pete Carroll wants to play.
There was a lot of Tedrick Thompson and Lano Hill this season. And I think for those people who watched those two safeties play, Lano Hill was too slow and Tedrick Thompson made too many mistakes. Was Marquise Blair significantly worse than either of those two? No, and I think Bradley McDougald deserves a lot of credit for how he played this season. I thought he was outstanding in the last couple of games in particular, and it helped out a whole lot because Quandre Diggs, I'm not sure, was 100% down the stretch. But as far as the other safeties that you have, I mean, in Marquise Blair, you had a guy who flew up to the ball, who laid people out, and he did not get enough playing time down the stretch. In Ugo Amadi, you have an explosive guy that, honestly, I think could be used in a variety of different ways. And you, instead of using him in a variety of different ways, chose to go with your base 4-3 defense more often than not. The scheme that they are putting out there is not maximizing the talent and the roster that they currently have. And there is talent. Cody Barton, I like what I saw from him. You're making a face.
I agree with what you said. This scheme is not maximizing the talent. I think I'd go with this. I don't think the talent is good enough to make the scheme work. I think that Seattle's scheme and that heavy dose of cover three, the reason that it worked so well in that four-year window is because they had extraordinary talent. And that if you simplify what's asked of them, if you don't overcomplicate things, if you don't blitz a ton, that frees up your players and allows them to play fast and tough and aggressive. That this isn't about the complexity of what we do. It's that what we do, we're so confident and so sure of, and we've got the athletes and we've got the players that are smart enough to take advantage of that lack of, and I don't know if you can get to that level. I don't know if you can get to that level of talent because, man, you knew in 2012 that they had a bunch of backbreakers on defense. And you look at it, I tend to agree with you going through all of the different guys. Bradley McDougal, does he need to be replaced?
McDougal.
I thought he played pretty well. Does you certainly need more of a pass rush, but you know what? That's the most expensive thing in the world, and you're already going to have to give a massive raise to Jadeveon Clowney, otherwise you're going to lose him. Was KJ Wright bad? No. Pete said that the final 2 months of the season, he was fantastic. Bobby Wagner was a Pro Bowler. And I look at it, well, somehow that's adding up all of that talent and potential. Is it because Trey Flowers is bad? Can't be one cornerback undoes everything, or that, man, it goes to hell if Quandre Diggs isn't there. And the one thing they did well is force turnovers, and they didn't get a single one in the final three games of the season.
I think they have more talent than they realize, if that makes sense on the defensive side of things. And let's throw out the defensive line right now, because the defensive line, we don't know what it's going to be at all next season. Whatever it was this year, though, it wasn't enough, clearly. I mean, Rasheem Green led you in sacks. That is not good. Even if Quentin Jefferson played well, and even if when Jadeveon Clowney was healthy, he was one of the best defenders in the league.
Well, stats aren't there.
That's not arguable. Watch the film. You had in Cody Barton a guy that I think down the stretch played really well. I think he has shown a keen understanding for what he is asked to do, and for a rookie to be doing that at the very end of the year, that's all you can ask for. But in Marquise Blair, you have a guy that can fly up to the line of scrimmage and a guy that can fly up and just absolutely lay people out. Why is a guy like that not being used as a blitzer? Ugo Amadi, also, that same kind of athletic burst. Why is he not out there to at least try in man coverage or in zone coverage to hang out and possibly make plays for you? I don't understand why those guys didn't play more. And you can give an explanation of, okay, well, we didn't trust them. But down the stretch this year, you were operating with a defense that was basically like a rickety boat that is trying to sail across the Atlantic Ocean. Okay, good luck. We'll see what happens when the wind moves one way or another. You don't know where you're going to end up. You might end up having to scuttle the thing halfway through the voyage, as opposed to, all right, let's just go aggressive and let's just maximize what we have. They didn't do that. They chose to stick with what they have. They chose to stick with the game plan, the scheme that they've been running for years and years. And I'm not going to act as if I understand all the nuance of a base 4-3, but what I do know is that there were guys that should have been on the field that weren't. And I think when you're bringing in an extra defensive back, a fifth defensive back, that allows for a Blair or an Amadi to be out there. And they were hesitant to do that. I think that was a mistake. And, you know, we saw that mistake in full effect against the Packers, especially in all those third and longs that they were unable to hold on.
My biggest fear is that this isn't a matter of them getting the best players on the field, that they have the best guys on the field, and that Marquise Blair, they couldn't trust him to be out there. And Cody Barton showed some promise and he improved. And Ugo Amadi, when he was on there, look, that pass play that he gave up to Davante Adams, it was a great play by Adams and Rodgers. It was a great throw by him. And Troy Aikman pointed out that Amadi made sort of a strategic mistake by lining up to grant or to set up Adams that allowed him to make an outside release. Pete made it pretty clear yesterday that that wasn't a situation that they were going with a one-on-one coverage there. That it turned out that the way the pattern developed, Delano Hill did have a chance to come over and help. But that was one-on-one coverage. That's how that was designed. So that means that your corner made it, and getting beat by Davante Adams in a one-on-one situation is no shame or no sort of thing.
One of the best in the game, right.
That wasn't a situation where there was a mental error there. That was physically getting beat in a one-on-one situation. My fear isn't that, hey, these coaches don't know how to diagnose talent. My fear is that this talent just isn't there this time, and they've spent a lot of resources. They've spent a lot of draft resources on safety specifically. Second-round pick on Blair, third-round pick on Delano Hill, fourth-round pick on Tedrick Thompson. They signed Bradley McDougal. They get Quandre Diggs in a trade. Like, all of those different things. You've spent these resources, and you just, it's not that you haven't been able to get the defense back to the level it was. It's that you haven't gotten a defense that's average, and without at least an average defense, that you can't play this style of football that really minimizes. Seattle put itself in a position both against San Francisco and Green Bay where it had to be perfect in the second half.
Yep.
It had to be pretty much perfect. Their offense had to score a touchdown. They're not just score every time. Their offense had to score a touchdown every time they got the ball, and they needed stops. And that's not a feasible formula for a long-term success. And it's not that they got away with it this year, but if you're going to take a step forward, either the players have to get better to maximize this scheme, or the scheme has to change to compensate for the fact that your players aren't as good as they were 5-6 years ago.
And it's definitely some combination of both. And now the next step is, okay, well, how do you better address the weaknesses of your team? I think the defensive line, the lack of a pass rush that they were able to create while they were running that base 4-3 is probably number one. And I do wonder, just having seen that blitz that they threw at Aaron Rodgers on that critical third down with Shaquille Griffin coming off of the edge, I just wonder why that wasn't something that they dialed up more of. Because I understand the idea that you want to play it safe, but you also want to generate pressure. The idea of just sitting back and acting like, okay, well, on certain plays, we're going to generate some pressure, but that's entirely reliant on individual talent to overcome. And outside of Jadeveon Clowney, the individual talent on that front just wasn't there. Help him out. Help him out in some way. And they either refused to or just thought it wasn't a good idea to do it. I think that blitz should tell them a whole lot about what they should be trying to do a little bit more of next season. Be aggressive, be trend-setting, and force the offense to react to you as opposed to always sitting back and hoping that the offense messes up going up against you.
Turns out that I have a problem with the seven stages of grief. The first stage is supposed to be shock and denial.
Right.
That was not how I felt yesterday.
Not at all. You were the exact opposite.
Is it seven or five? Because there's different conflicting reports about this.
It's changing.
Seven at least is the book that I had that I've read several times this past year. So maybe I exaggerated and I've got seven stages of grief and I'm just better at grief than other people.
We can have as many as we want.
Now, I think that I've gone from acceptance and hope, which is supposed to be the final stage. I think that's where I started. And then I've moved to anger and bargaining, which is the third step. That's where I'm at right now. So I've gone acceptance and hope to anger and bargaining. Next is either going to be shock and denial or pain and guilt. And I'm not really sure. Probably.
What would you rather pain, have?
Well, shock and denial, because at least that's sort of disbelief. Like pain and guilt. Like, I was raised Catholic. I've got all sorts of guilt issues. So that comes to me fairly naturally. So I'm afraid I'm headed toward pain and guilt, but it could be shock and denial. And then depression's going to come in here at some point. So I got that to look forward to. But yeah, I'm firmly in anger and bargaining right now.
You can circle back to acceptance and hope. You can end where you started.
Are you sure? I don't know if I'm going to get there.
I don't know. I've never made it through all seven.
Maybe reconstruction and working through. Like, maybe that's something I can look toward to. I'm certainly nowhere near the upward turn. That's stage five. Yeah, the upward turn didn't happen for me. I had the downward turn. That's nowhere here on my seven stages of grief. Where are you at, Paul?
I am, you know what? I think I'm at the end. I've already accepted it.
Acceptance and hope?
It was going to be really hard for me to be mad about this team losing because I thought that where they got to, considering some of the defensive issues that they had, offensive line issues that they had, and injuries, it's hard for me to be mad about how the season ended. Now, you bringing up the statistic about the amount of points that the Seahawks have scored in the first half of these divisional road playoff games and the amount of points that the opposition has scored in these divisional road playoff games has me trending a little bit towards anger. But again, I feel like this team really overachieved this season. And
Lydia, where are you at in the seven stages of grief?
Pass. Can I pass?
Okay.
I'm probably just at acceptance. Yeah. Hope. Jess? I'm always on hope, Danny.
Okay. The great, great, hopeful Lydia. Jess, where are you at? Seven stages.
I'm a game breaker when it comes to this grief thing. So I shot all the way through to reconstruction and working through. I'm already thinking of what they can do this offseason. In my head, Jadeveon is already signed, and you know we're working through that right now. I do think he wants to be here, and I'm gonna hit acceptance and hope pretty hard. Maybe right after the Super Bowl as we look ahead to the draft.
Yep, apparently I'm the only angry one. It's Danny and Gallant.
We always need an angry one.
That's me. Ranting around right here. It's Danny and Gallant. We go around the NFL now.
It's time to go around the NFL. Brought to you by Toyota of Puyallup. The bottom line on the biggest stories in the NFL every morning at 9:15 with Danny and Gallant.
Today's an exceptional day.
Exceptionally angry day for me.
Let it out, Danny.
I'm a therapist. There are five stages of grief, and the stages don't have to go in order. It's just stages. You don't have to go through all of them. You can pick and choose. It's like a potpourri, a veritable buffet. Jess, what do we got?
Or as Jim Moore would say, a berry bowl buffet. Well, as
stupid
we...
Stupid things he was worried about.
As we all know by now, the Chiefs went down to an early 24-0 deficit. And at that point in the game, a fan went viral as he took to Twitter to announce that he was a jinx and he was leaving. Patrick Mahomes, after that historic comeback the Chiefs had, was asked about it.
If you talk about the fans and how important they were, there was one fan that's now going viral. He left when you guys were down 24-0 because he said it was in the best interest of the team. What would you say to that fan?
Watch the next game at home.
I'm still not used to his voice, man.
It is shocking when it comes out of his face.
It gets me every time. It sounds like 50 years of hard living. That's what that sounds like, man. That sounds like cobwebs and broken glass.
I've long felt that Patrick Mahomes sounds like what Ed Orgeron and Kermit the Frog would have if they created a love child together, and that love child just went on to smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day.
Yeah, I have decided I am rooting for the Chiefs. I don't want it to be the Titans. I want the Chiefs to win. The Chiefs have good fans. Patrick Mahomes is a blast to watch. I am all aboard the Chiefs wagon. Okay, number two is the Titans, and after that, I'm rooting for the Asteroid.
I am having a hard time picking a team because I can't stand all of these teams that are left. I just can't. I don't like Travis Kelce on the Chiefs. Tyrann Mathieu was annoying in his time in Houston with me covering him, so I'm not a fan of him either. No matter how much I like Mahomes and Andy Reid, I'm still thinking on this one, Danny. This one's going to be really, really hard.
It's really shocking to me that you have strong negative opinions about everyone. Mahomes stinks.
I didn't say that about Reid.
Travis
I like
Kelce
both of them.
Stinks.
Kelsey's annoying.
Tyrann
Mathieu
stinks.
He is also annoying and insufferable. Many people would say the same thing about me. You know, maybe
Ryan Tannehill stinks.
He does. Maybe the one way to take the bull by the horns here is to do the one thing that would infuriate the fan base that I cannot stand the most in the National Football League. That would be the Tennessee Titans. If I were to become a Titans fan, that would take away their joy because they would have to realize that I am now rooting for them. So you know what? Screw it. I'm going to be a Titans fan now. It's all about Derrick Henry. Ryan Tannehill, what a quarterback, man. Woohoo! Less than 100 yards a game. Oh, yeah.
I'm in shock and denial right now. I don't know how to feel about that. Well, this may have happened before the season or during the season before he came out of retirement, but Marshawn Lynch, apparently on an episode of Bar Rescue, and obviously that's going to be fantastic.
Really, he's drinking behind the bar? Is that cool?
I'm from 2-3. They call me Big 2-3.
I mean, his freestyle was just weak. Not only that... He done put them dirty-ass butt cheeks all on the board.
Everybody's got to hold up their own. Everybody's got to freaking deliver. As a team, we lose.
Hey, you might have been an all right coach in the league. You got me ready to go and bust some motherfucking heads right now.
I want to go, and let's go and talk to them.
So how many times do you walk by this and not pick up anything?
You wait till they finish.
I don't understand it. What do you do here?
So I'm the only person in here. I'm not a server. I'm a bartender.
You know, the more you talk, the more of an idiot you sound like. You walk by it and didn't
do it. Walk by it. Stop.
Check me out though, cuz. The whole point of all this why he's telling you what he's telling you is that's coming out of my pocket.
Marshawn Lynch as the boss is hilarious. Marshawn Lynch, like, can you imagine Marshawn Lynch the boss having Marshawn Lynch the employee?
Yes, no. I mean, doesn't he have at least a
get
shot?
Get on the bus, Marshawn. No.
I am a big fan of John Taffer. He is one of my favorite people in the world. I think that is he inspirational, but I also love when he gets into people and lights them up. I think he's a really good life coach. I seriously do think that to combine him with Marshawn Lynch for an entire episode of television on one of my favorite shows, Bar Rescue, because I love it when these people refuse to take John Taffer's advice, and then like 5 months later, the place is bankrupt and is decrepit. It's a great show. Can't wait for this.
That is my favorite thing, is Taffer comes in and gives them honest advice, and they pay to remake it and make it better, and then I would say half the time, the people are like, well, that's not how I want this bar to be. So it goes back to being exactly how it was when they had the problems.
There's a great like parallel between what this and then what we're talking about, coaches taking analytic advice earlier. Well, here's all the things that would help you out. But you know what? I'm just going to go with what works for me.
I'm going to go with my gut. Yeah. There's a lot of things
I do. As we mentioned earlier today, Odell Beckham Jr. was at the site of the national championship game last night and was seen handing the winning Tigers a bunch of cash. It is now speculated that that might be fake. And if I were with any compliance department, that is exactly the kind of rumor I'd be putting out there right now.
Or to say it was, hey, it was guys that have already exhausted their eligibility. I don't care about college athletes being paid. I really don't. It doesn't bother me. I don't care. I care that Odell Beckham is making this about him, and he's an alum.
Superstar.
It's about those kids in that moment. And maybe you could say, hey, the players that are there really liked it, and they're getting the spotlight put on them thanks to Odell Beckham. I don't like Odell Beckham. I don't like the way he seeks attention. And I think that that's my problem with this. Not any sort of impropriety in paying college kids. He's not the story here.
I used to think that Odell Beckham Jr. got a bad rap, and then this season happened. After forcing his way out of New York, where I felt like he had just cause to want to get out of there. They loved Eli Manning too much. Dave Gettleman seems completely incompetent. But then he comes here, and this entire season, it has been whining and whining and whining and whining and more whining. It's unfair to compare him to Antonio Brown, who is a legitimately bad person. But at the same time, this guy goes out of his way, as you said, Danny, to make himself the center of attention. It's tiresome.
It's interesting that you brought up Antonio Brown. I'm not sure how many people saw the video yesterday. He went on Instagram Live with himself yelling at the mother of one of his children with at least four police officers there, ordering them to escort her away because she was trying to take his car, his Bentley. He's cursing her out. He's saying all these horrible things there in front of kids, one of which is his. Anybody who watches that, the question of what the NFL should do to Antonio Brown should be completely null and void. If any team will employ that guy after seeing that, the morally bankrupt nature. If you would choose to have that guy that treats someone who's the mother of his child that way in public in front of police officers, you've shown exactly who you are. The NFL should never have to decide that again, because any person with any semblance of a social conscience would never employ him to play professional football.
Can't disagree at all. And honestly, who would have thought that it would have been better for him to be singing his hit single Whole Lot of Money in that situation, as opposed to what he was saying there? It was awful.
It's Danny and Gallant. We will get back to the Seahawks and what they'll have to do. And maybe someone has the actual answer to why they're so bad in the first half of these playoff games. We'll tell you what that is next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Finally got the explanation that I was looking. What's the difference between the first and the second half of the Seattle Seahawks, especially in Sunday's game, from the 509? On the first half, they got amped up to Aerosmith's Dream On.
Yep.
At halftime, they went and listened to We Will Rock You and then came out and kicked some butt. That's exactly right. They took Paul Gallant's advice, came out to some sad sack of a motivational track.
Sad sack, get lost.
And slept through the first half of the game. And then at halftime, Pete Carroll was like, we got to get something to get him fired up. So he turned on the best motivational song of all time, and we all saw the result.
I was sabotaged by the selection of a live song. Sabotaged. Yeah, you heard what I said. I'm not motivated right now. The only thing I'm motivated to do is to stop this music. Alexa, pause.
It's impossible.
Sabotage, also a good pump-up song.
That's actually a great one.
It is absolutely impossible to listen to that song and not for me to thrust my fist in the air and to get motivated for that. I'm not sure. This can't be something just as simple as, hey, they need to get desperate before they get good. I don't believe that. Yet, it's so undeniable the trend of they fall down on the road in that road divisional playoff game and then make this heroic comeback. And it's happened five different times, and all five times they played on the road in that round, which means you're going against a team that's coming off of a bye. You're playing on the road. The similarities in that storyline is just jarring to me.
What do you do? Do you have Pete Carroll create some sort of James Bond-esque villain lair and say to your players before every single game, all right, well, your entire family is right now in this prison, and there are sharks with laser beams on their head that are surrounding them. If you don't get it done, the sharks with laser beams are going to get the victory. And if you do get it done, all right, everyone's free.
It does feel like this is similar to the argument about closers needing a save situation, which is probably the argument I hate most in baseball. The idea that your closer needs to be in a save situation, because if he's not in that situation, he won't have the edge you've needed. Which I'm like, okay, if that's true, you need psychologists as much as pitching coaches, because there's no reason that someone can't summon that energy or train themselves to put the same importance on a tie game when it's just as much the outcome in doubt. It should be just as, you should have every bit of adrenaline edge there. And if it is a case that you need to have a save situation to be at your best, well, let's create a sensory deprivation chamber and let's train the guy not to look at the scoreboard when he comes into the game. So you can convince him that it is a save situation when he comes in to be able to do that. So if this is just a mental thing, if it's just needing to feel that your back's against the wall, you should be able to work around that. The idea that there's something schematic here, or not schematic, that's the wrong word, that the fact that it's something that Russell needs to feel and work his way toward in a game, I guess I can understand that. Maybe it's just the simple fact that you get down that big and the defense is going to let up and they're going to stop. The important thing becomes not making plays, but avoiding disaster. And so they start scoring a lot of points. But that fact that opponents in the five road divisional playoff games Seattle has played under Pete Carroll have outscored Seattle 112-13 in the first half is jarring.
It really is. And if you look at how they have played this season, for the most part, it's held true in the regular season too, hasn't it? I mean, it took them until the second quarter to get going in the season opener against the Cincinnati Bengals. It took them until the fourth quarter to get things going against the New Orleans Saints. The Browns, they didn't get things started until the second half. The Buccaneers, they didn't get things started until the second half. Took them a little bit of time to get rolling against Minnesota as well. And also, you saw it against San Francisco. You saw it against the Green Bay Packers in the second go-round against San Francisco. So it's not just a playoff thing. It's a every single season kind of thing. And that means it probably falls on Russell Wilson, doesn't it? Because if Russell Wilson is someone who needs to, as described to us, get in a bit of a rhythm, then somehow they have to find a way to make that rhythm happen earlier. What is the way to do that? I'm not sure what the way it is to do that. I really have no idea outside of like starting a game by just spreading it out and saying, all right, Russ, let's go no huddle. You get to call the plays at the line of scrimmage and you get to feel what works and what doesn't work. But even there, that doesn't seem like a sound strategy either. That seems
Why
like
not?
It, doesn't it seem like it's playground? Like it's,
yes.
Is playground good for the National Football League where
it's how they get back in games. I mean, that's how they play in the second half. I think there's a legitimate question. Can you do that for 60 minutes? Can you do that for 60 minutes? The worry or the fear that I have is that Seattle used to have the defense that was capable of keeping them in games in the first half when their offense stumbled through it, and then was capable of slamming the door shut once the offense got going, and that their defense isn't that good anymore. So the holes are bigger, and they're not as resilient in the second half. They're not as able to, once Seattle turns on the jets and goes right by, well, they're not able to stop the opposing defenses. That the formula that has worked of keeping it close for a half, well, the problem is Seattle can't keep it close for a half anymore because the defense isn't good enough. And in that way, you're in a situation where you've got to outscore them. And in that case, I'm not against the idea of trying some different things with your early approach and trying some different things in the first half to see if you can get things going earlier.
You can't keep doing the same thing, whatever the case. And I hope that they go into this offseason really thinking long and hard about why it is that their offense takes as long to get going. You can say, all right, well, he needs to feel out a game. He needs to get into a rhythm. But that is something that after a long period of time, if you have that understanding about Russell Wilson, you need to tailor things in a way where he can get into that rhythm as quickly as he possibly can, period.
Yeah, it'll be – They've got a lot of things to build around on their offense. They've got a couple questions about their offense. And then they've got, I think, a fundamental question about their defense is what needs to change on there? Can you get the personnel to the point where it can execute this scheme? Or do you need to find different things schematically to cover up for the fact that the defense wasn't as effective this past year? Because the comparison of 2012, the one problem with that is that your defense was already loaded and you added pass rushers to it. Right now, you've got a defense that is a long way from loaded, and you're going to have to pay to keep your best pass rusher.
Exactly.
That's a tough formula. That's a tough formula to say, hey, you can just bring it back, and we were just banged up, and injuries were the big thing that derailed this season. Because I'm not sure if you reload and just get healthy that that's going to be enough next year to get over this hump.
I remember when I first came here that I thought this Seahawks pass rush, because it had a Ziggy Ansah, who in theory could be the guy that he used to be, and a Jaron Reed who had 10.5 sacks the season before, in addition to Jadeveon Clowney, gave them as many weapons pass rush-wise as the Seahawks had back in the early 2010s. Because when they brought in, you know, Cliff Avril, when they changed things and they had all of these guys that could get after the quarterback, Michael Bennett as well, and it didn't happen. I wonder if maybe Jaron Reed's suspension just kept him from ever being able to be the kind of player that he needed to be. And perhaps the Seahawks lucked into maybe bringing him back on a discount in addition to bringing back a Jadeveon Clowney because of the way that he was, because they stuck behind him through the suspension. He is someone that I wonder, what is he truly? Is he the guy that we saw a couple of years ago, or is he the guy that we saw this past season where it just wasn't there for whatever reason? It's not to say that he never had an impact, but the kind of impact that we thought he could have, he wasn't anywhere close to having it.
It is Danny and Gallant. We're going to throw our flags next, and then we'll clear out of the way for the professor who's touchdown and back in Seattle. That's all ahead.
From the pocket, and flags everywhere.
Flag on the play.
Now there's a flag down.
Every morning at 9:45 with Danny and Gallant. Brought to you by Carter Volkswagen.
If the noise persists, the defense will be charged with a timeout.
Flag on the play.
Officiating wasn't that big a deal over the weekend. I know we got some complaints in the Seattle game, but
Pac-12 refs were trending, Danny.
Oh, were they?
Last night, Pac-12 yeah. And Pac-12 finally made it back to the national championship as the refs.
The referees. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. I could do without the announcements about like conference affiliations in the officiating. Like, you want the officials to be furniture, don't you? You want to not worry about
totally.
Them. They should just be there. Yeah. Anyway, it's time to throw flags. Paul, you want to start?
Yeah. I'm going to raise a flag here. Listen, there's nothing like a great bit of sideline reporting. And in Sunday's Seahawks-Packers game, I was really concerned that Jadeveon Clowney had suffered a serious injury.
Of course.
because he had that core injury going into the game, and he dropped to the floor, and it looked really, really painful. But the moment of relief, and on top of that, the moment of amusement came courtesy of Chris Myers, who was sideline reporter for that game.
On that last series, what do you know, Chris Myers?
Well, at first over on the sideline, we thought it was a muscle pull, but when he came over here, he indicated to his teammates that he was keeled over in pain. I mean, eye-watering pain, and I don't know how you say this on television. Let's just say he got hit in the family jewels, and eventually he walked it off, told him he was okay, grabbed his helmet, wanted to be in on that goal line stand. They said, just wait, he'll be ready for the next defensive series, at least as ready as one can be.
Okay, Chris.
All right, Chris.
Attaboy.
That was my favorite moment of the game. It's unfortunate that he got hit in the family jewels for that goal line sequence. You wonder, okay, well, maybe if Clowney's in there on a third and one, maybe he can keep Aaron Jones from getting into the end zone. But great job of reporting, Chris Myers, finding out that it wasn't a hernia, it wasn't a torso, it was the family jewels who kept Clowney off the field.
That was very funny phrasing, and I believe Joe Buck gave an acknowledgement to the Weird Science reference, which if that's really where that originated from, that was some impressive attribution by Joe Buck, who'd be able to put that together. That's a good one. Lydia, you got a flag?
I'm going to throw a flag on all the people who... We're getting a lot of text-splaining happening this morning about the stages of grief. Hey, you know what? I think everybody can have as many stages as they want and go through them however they want. So I'm going to throw a flag on those people because, you know, you do you when it comes to grief.
I have one stage of grief. It's eternal rage. That's Danny O'Neill today.
Yeah. What? Really?
Yeah. I've been mad. I didn't respond to any of those because the last time we got a text about that, I probably overreacted to it. Someone complained about me using and referring to someone as passing on instead of saying died, and that it was trying to gloss over the realities of that. And so I responded to that person. I was like, as someone who has watched both of my parents die in slow, agonizing fashion, I appreciate you explaining to me the importance about the permanence of death. It was unnecessary. It was totally unwarranted. Like, that person didn't mean it that way. And it was a heavy-handed response. It's possible I'm becoming a worse person.
No,
it is. That's definitely true. Twitter makes me worse. There's no doubt about that.
It makes everyone worse. You're not alone on that front.
I am a worse person. Jess?
I'm raising a flag for the Washington State Athletic Department. Athletic Director Pat Chun for finding Nick Rolovich out of Hawaii as the presumed and not officially announced next head coach, but it's all but done. I'm sure that he had to travel quite a ways to get here. He had apparently visited Mike Leach 2 years ago in Key West when he transformed his offense into a run and shoot. So now he's replacing him. And everything that I've heard from the world of college football who has dealt with him, not just here within the state or within the Pac-12, people on a national level as well have said that this is an absolutely wonderful hire. And I was a little bit, I don't know. Maybe I was going through my own stages of grief and having to let go of 8 years of covering one coach in Mike Leach, but it sounds like this is going to be great.
Have you talked or done a scouting report? How aggressive does he try to evade the sideline reporters for the radio broadcast?
Well,
one
national sideline reporter reached out to me who has worked 3 Hawaii games, and she said that I'm going to love him. So that makes me think he's not as mobile during interviews as Mike Leach was.
Well, that's good. I like the fact he's got some Northern California roots. And there's nothing that prepares a man to succeed in Pullman like coaching in Hawaii. There's a lot of similarities in the environment, in the weather, and all of the different things that you can get used to, correct?
Picking up on your sarcasm there.
Yeah, what's up with that, huh? Huh?
Well,
yeah, you see,
true.
I'm wearing a Coug shirt right now, Danny. You were here? We'd have some words.
The answer to that is, I hope so, because I'm laying it on pretty thick.
I'm going to throw a flag on myself for being an incorrigible jerk today. Or incorrigible. That's a incorrigible.
Incorrigible. Yeah, you got it that time.
I got fixated. I got hung up. I got hung up on the first half scoring deficit in divisional playoff games, which I realize is not the ultimate end-all be-all. I became very angry. I'm still mad.
I like that you're fixated on it. This is a healthy emotion to have, Danny. That is a ridiculous statistic.
112 points to 13 points in the first half of divisional playoff games played on the road under Pete Carroll.
What's that, Danny? What's that?
112 to 13.
112 to 13.
112 to 13. It's five times it's happened. I watched the same game every single time.
How do you really feel about it, though?
I feel like every year then I get brainwashed or glamored by Pete Carroll, who comes in and explains that, oh, everything was better because we finished it on an uptick. And Russell Wilson gives the Oscar De La Hoya interview, which Oscar De La Hoya, after he fought, when you saw his post-fight interview, you could not tell whether he won or lost. It was the same every time. He had this weird permanent grin on his face, and he was so hyper and excited. It was the same thing every time, and I feel like Russell gives that to me, and I eat it up and then come away into the offseason like, yeah, we're going to go get him next year, just like 2012 all over again. And then same stuff keeps happening to the same guy.
112 to 13, Danny.
Yeah.
You're not the only one, Danny. You're speaking for some other fans who are probably just need to hear it from you.
A bunch of other angry idiots as well. Like, we'll all go be miserable together somewhere.
I'm pretty aware we have angry fans. Angry listeners.
Yeah, that's right. I'm your muse. I'm your vessel. Let me speak your rage. It's going to do it for us. I'm going to go shut up for a while.
I feel like this is a healthy energy to have with you, though. You know, go to the workout. You're going to do some max reps. 112 to 13.
No, I still can't do that because I've got to recover from a hernia surgery.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
I can't lift anything more than 10 pounds, which is part of the problem as well.
Why don't you get that 10-pound weight, though, and use that 112 to 13 energy?
112 curls on one arm and then 13 on the other? See how that feels.
You'll be really swole on one arm. It'll be your first half arm, and you'll be not swole on the other arm. It's your second half arm.
That's going to do it for us. Thanks to Lydia Cruz, to Jessamyn McIntyre, to the professor for making it back safely. We're going to see you tomorrow at 7 a.m. on Danny and Gallant.
It was just so much fun.